This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live with a wonderful guest today with quite a bit of accomplishment here that you will want to know about. And before we start, I just want to remind you all that every one of life's experiences has within it the seeds of a love letter to someone, either appreciation or a flirtation or memories or apologies, anything at all. Your truth put to paper in the most compassionate and loving way counts as a love letter. And with that, I am going to go to my guest, Robin Friday, who is a documentary producer and director, and you've done two of them now, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so I'm going to go to you. Talk about, like, where are you from originally? I've just met, by the way, so I don't know Robin yet.
Yes, thank you, Janet. It's so great to be here. I am originally from Chicago, grew up there, and moved away as a teenager. And My family moved. We moved to Florida for a short time.
Oh, with your family.
And then I came to California, and I've actually been in Nevada in Northern California for quite some time. My son was 4 months old, my older son.
Oh.
He's now 34, so it's been
a long time. Oh, so you have been here a long time.
Yes.
I see. Okay, I didn't know. And so when did you know that you were going to be making documentaries?
Well, I didn't know that until I embarked on my first documentary, which was in 2008.
Tell us the title and what it's about and what made you do it.
Yeah. Well, my background had been as a still photographer.
Oh, okay.
And I always worked with children, different nonprofit causes. And in 2008, as we were heading into the election before Barack Obama was nominated, I was sitting at home and I just started to think about the people who brought us to this possible election. And it.
Who are those people?
I was thinking in particular about the foot soldiers of the civil rights movement, the people who marched, the people who fought for the right to vote.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And at that point, the country was still saying, we're not ready for this. We're not ready for an African-American president. But I thought even to be having this discussion, to be this close, I was curious as to how those who fought for the right to vote felt.
Of course, you know, people are terrified of what's new, I think. They like what's old, yes, because people said the same thing about Kennedy.
Absolutely.
We can't have a Catholic president.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So I called up my mom and I said, I'm going to make a documentary, having no idea what that really meant.
That's what I was curious about. So you just dove in
I
you.
Said, what are you doing this August? Why don't we go to Birmingham for a couple of weeks? And I wanted to do some research.
What year was this now?
2008. This was 2008.
Okay.
Yes. So this was right before he was nominated, and we took a trip. We went to Birmingham, Alabama, and I went to the Civil Rights Institute. I started meeting people. I was introduced to foot soldiers, and then somebody said to me, have you met the barber? And so our next visit was to the barber shop where we met Mr. Armstrong, who is the subject of this documentary, The Barber of Birmingham.
Okay.
And so after Mr. Armstrong was 85. He had his barber shop there since 1950. He was the first to integrate his sons into an all-white school. He carried the original flag and the Bloody Sunday March from Selma to Montgomery.
What a scary thing to do.
This man dedicated his entire life. Yes, he moved into an all-white neighborhood. He had his dog was poisoned.
Oh,
his house was being bombed. He put his family and himself at great risk. But
was this with the consent of his family?
Interesting. Very interesting question. His wife knew that they were in harm's way at a point. She went away with the children for a period of time, but she agreed to let him do it. She knew, he had a vision of something much greater, and he stayed with it. And so we, after meeting him and seeing his barbershop, which was something like a museum. It was a small, tiny shop, but every inch of space was covered with memorabilia from the civil rights movement. And listening to his stories, and he was a quite a character. He wore his suspenders with plaid pants. He had this great smile. He just was adorable. And so I decided that I would tell this story of the foot soldiers through the eyes of this man. And came back to the Bay Area and still had no idea how to make a documentary.
So where do you start?
But I met some great people, and then...
You met some great people. You knew who to go out to look for?
I did. I met some, in Birmingham, I met some of the foot soldiers. And then I came back here and was introduced to a filmmaker, Gail Dolgen. At the time when we met, she was in stage 4 of breast cancer. Oh. She was an award-winning documentary filmmaker. But she felt so passionate about this idea. I sent her pictures of Mr. Armstrong, and I told her this idea that I had for this film, and she loved it. And 2 weeks later, we were off and shooting this documentary right in time for the election.
Now, when you shooting this documentary, you went back then to Birmingham,
right?
We went
back to Birmingham. We put together a team.
You had a script that you had written?
We did not have a script.
It was a narrated kind of thing?
It was, yeah, a documentary. We were just following life as it happened. So we had a film crew, and we went back to follow Mr. Armstrong as he was at the polls voting, and you know, his coming out and talking about it, and the days leading up to the election and the days following and then the inauguration. And so we followed Mr. Armstrong from November of 2008. He passed away in November of 2009.
Oh.
And then my co-director, Gail, passed away after that. So it was a very, very difficult time. And 2 days before...
Even though you knew that you were coming in at the kind of the late stages of both lives.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And Gail did know that this would be her last film. And
you knew that the barber was older.
He was older, yes. And we watched him close his barber shop.
Ooh.
And yeah, it was very sad. And at the same time,
did Gail get to see the movie?
What Gail got to see, Gail and I had created a sample that we were using for fundraising. And just days before Gail passed, she was in hospice care at her home. And she called a business meeting, and she wanted to discuss the future of the film. And we actually made the decision at that point to use the sample that we had created and send it to Sundance. And not really ever expecting that it would be accepted. It was not a finished piece. It was far from it. But Gail passed away 2 days later, and then I got the call that the film was accepted to Sundance. And we decided, a great team of friends and filmmakers from Berkeley who Gail had worked with all came together to help me finish this film. And it premiered at Sundance. We decided to keep much of it intact because it was the last film that Gail worked on.
Now, is this something we can order on Netflix, for example, under documentaries? Or
it's not. You can order it actually right now. We're with it's called The Video Project. It's an educational distribution company, and it can be ordered through them.
Okay.
And so, so we really wanted to create a film that would be used for education to educate future generations
about that time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what surprised us, we screened to many groups of high school students, including in Birmingham, and what we realized was that the youth did not know this history, even in Birmingham, Alabama, where it took place, and it was their parents and grandparents. So that's what our hope was with this documentary. And
that's interesting because it touches on something about kids and the next generation.
Yeah.
And the impatience sometimes of having to listen to the same old story again from your parents. It's like, let's move along. I've got things to do today. And so it could get lost.
And I think that's exactly one of the reasons. And the other is sometimes what we found were people did not want to talk about history.
You want to see yourself at the stronger place where you finally land, not,
Right. So a lot of times it was just not being shared by the parents and
grandparents. That's wonderful because those children and grandchildren, when they get to a certain age, that's their legacy. And they're going to want to know about it when they're older.
Exactly.
I mean, this is very much like the value of love letters, just what you've done here. We'll talk about that later. Okay.
Great.
So what is your other one? You said you did two.
Yes.
Now, did you do, you've done one since then?
So since then, that film went on to receive an Academy Award nomination, which was very, very exciting, a great honor. And then when I was finished with that film, I was visiting my son, who was in the Navy, and he was in Japan. He was a lawyer in the Navy, and we were discussing the current wars and
now, what year was this again?
This was in 2012.
Oh, so right now, pretty much. Okay.
Yes. So we were discussing the effects of the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury and some of these invisible injuries. And I really wanted to make a film about that, but I wanted to make a film that was a hopeful story. Mm-hmm. There have been many documentaries made that are hard for me to watch myself because they may be very violent. You may walk away feeling that there's no hope.
Right, and hopelessness is really a killer.
Yes.
I'm glad you're saying that.
So I wanted to tell the story in a way that would offer veterans, their families, and, you know,
okay,
the
so
society.
So how did you go about this?
I'm so interested
in the starting point, because from nothing to something is huge.
It is. So,
and by the way,
actually,
kind of daunting, and I have a feeling that people can be discouraged enough at the prospect to drop it, even if they have.
Yes. Yes, but
so how do you start?
I would encourage to keep just one foot in front of the other, just each day to do.
But how did you start with this one?
Well, how I started was I actually came across a story that was about a veteran at a facility in Washington, in Yelm, Washington, called Rainier Therapeutic Riding, and it was about equine therapy.
Oh.
And how it is now equine
therapy. Oh, that's how you got your title.
Yeah. So it's been around for a long time, helping children. They found it to be very effective with children with autism and different disabilities. But in 2006, it was introduced by somebody from Israel. And it was introduced to this country to work with the soldiers.
Oh, because they had done it there with
soldiers?
They
had done it there. They had done it there and found it to be very effective treatment. And so I contacted ended up being my co-director on this film, Peter Rosenbaum. We had been friends since we were 5 years old. We grew up in Chicago together as next-door neighbors. He's an amazing photographer and was at a transition point in his life. And I said, why don't you do this film with me? And he's a great artist, and he agreed. And so we had quite a journey together. We started the research going to Rainier Therapeutic Riding. We went to Washington,
D.C. So this is one place. I mean, are there these kind of equine therapy centers all over the country?
They are all over the country.
Okay.
Yes. We happened to start there. Mm-hmm. Then we went to others in other states. We went to Washington. And we started researching, and we wanted to see for ourselves what this was all about.
Okay.
And
so this film is about this aspect.
This film is really the personal story of one soldier.
And what's the title of it?
It's called Riding My Way Back. And our website is ridingmywayback.com. We have a lot of information. You can order the film through there. But the film is about Sergeant Aaron Heliker, who had been deployed many times to Iraq and Afghanistan and returned with post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury.
No, those are two different things. Can we talk about that? Because one is a physical, right?
One is physical. One was from the many blasts that affected his brain. Post-traumatic stress affects many, many soldiers returning home in different ways. Aaron it showed in his relationships with people. When he came home, he pushed people away from him. He isolated. He suffered from alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And anger, isolating, different mm-hmm. ways, and he became suicidal. Mm. And he was very close to ending his life because he was 27 years old, my. And he was discharged from the service, and that was really the only thing he ever knew or ever wanted to do. He grew
up.
So
that gets back, we were talking before about basing your identity on one physical part of yourself, and then what do you have left?
What do you have after that? I think it's very common with a lot of these men and women. He grew up in a small farm town in Pennsylvania, and all he dreamed of was going one day to serve our country, mm-hmm. and he planned on doing that for the rest of his life. And then after his injuries, he was discharged, and he didn't see a future for himself. He thought, what is there now? And
he was in a physical state, or that he couldn't have stayed in the Army because
correct.
Of his brain injury. Oh, so
both,
that's really,
post-traumatic stress, right. brain injury. He had a number of other physical injuries as well, uh-huh. so the combination
So he
of
was
everything.
Suddenly unfit for that life.
He was suddenly unfit, okay. and he had to...
So he must have had somebody who loved him, who got him, or I shouldn't assume anything, but how did he get from this stage of drinking and suicidal and anger to the...
It was very interesting. He was based at Fort Lewis McChord up in Washington, and he was not able to live in the barracks, so he was living on somebody's property there in a trailer home. And that person happened to be friends with the one, Debbie Fisher, who owned the therapeutic writing.
Oh, okay.
And she said, you know, I have a soldier who's really could use your help. He's very depressed. She didn't know the extent of his depression, that he was actually very close to mm-hmm. committing suicide. He had written a note. But Debbie reached out to him, and she called him one day, and she said, you know, I have this horse named Fred, and I could really use your help out here. Would you mind coming out and helping me? And Aaron is always there to help someone.
Oh.
And so he put the gun down, which was literally in his mouth, and he said, you know, I can postpone this. I can do this tomorrow. I'll go out and help Debbie. And he went out to the ranch, and he met Fred, and he fell in love. And every day, Debbie, without asking questions, without probing, she didn't know. She doesn't ask questions, so she didn't know exactly, but she could see it in him that
he
needed
help. And so she'd say, can you come back tomorrow?
She would find another excuse. Can you come back tomorrow? I could really use you. Fred needs you. Fred misses you. She would keep finding reasons to bring him back.
What a smart angel.
Yes, she is his angel, yes. And pretty soon pretty soon he put the gun away, and he said... He didn't need it anymore, and he found a mission, and his mission now is he is being trained to work with other veterans.
Oh, my goodness.
His goal in life is to have his own ranch and to help others, and the entire time we were making this film about him, it was very, very difficult because these soldiers have, a lot of times, trust issues, and here we were, a couple of unknown people, he didn't know us, and to share and open up and share his story was very hard for him. But what he kept saying over and over is, if I can make a difference in one soldier's life, if he can, doesn't have to go through what I did, if I can save one other person, then me telling my story is worth it. And
so this film that you've made, I can, you know, the importance of it in reaching out and making this known, because this is a very, very tiny thin line between this man's death and what he is today. And that thin line is, it just happened to be a human being who knew somebody who bothered to say hello.
And this connection with this
horse. If her dryer buzzer had gone off and she hadn't gone out to talk to him at that moment.
Yes.
It would have been
Aaron may not be where he is today. Yes.
Oh, the tiny moments that save lives.
Absolutely. And so, and he understands that, and that's why he's out there telling his story, and it was hard for him. But this film, we premiered it this year during Veterans Week at 115 venues across the country.
Oh, I was going to ask where, so that people can know about.
Yes. So we were at the Capitol, and we were at many universities, Columbia, Rutgers. Aaron traveled with us, and and shared his story along with Debbie Fisher, who runs the Rainier Therapeutic Riding, and Mindy Fisher, who is Debbie's daughter and who is now Aaron's fiance.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, yes. And so it's a wonderful story. Aaron has found, you know, it's not that he's out of the woods. He struggles every day, but he has found a purpose.
Okay. And that struggles every day is still within safety, you'd say? Well, who knows these things?
Yes.
That's a silly question.
I do like to think so. And he has now, he has the support of a lot of great people who loves. And I think having a purpose is something that Mr. Armstrong talked about in my first film. And it's something Aaron.
Okay, so I wanted to make that connection.
Yes.
Not really just between the two projects that you did, but you. There is. I'm listening, and there is something about foot soldiers and soldiers, and there's something about, it seems to me, that there is a battleground for change. What is it that has gripped you? Do you know why, can you say?
I think it's change, and I think I'm always drawn to the voices who are not necessarily heard. And I think, you know, when I was...
But there are lots of those. I mean, you seem to have a coming back from devastation feel, like how to approach that and change things.
Yeah, I think so. And I think even in my, it's carried over from my still photography work, which was mostly with children,
but healthy children,
foster care. Uh-huh. I co-founded in the Bay Area Heart Gallery, which was an exhibit between, it was a collaboration between social services and photographers to photograph children in need of homes. It's wonderful. But yeah, so I think that what I hope to do, what I love to do, what really nurtures me is to be able to use whatever skills I have to help those who are
underserved. Well, you know, I can see that you're a gentle and soft-spoken, unassuming kind of person, and yet you want to speak real loud and clear for others who can speak less. Is that? I mean, that's what it looks like.
That's true. That's true.
Okay.
Yeah, I do want to give voice to, you know, I think that we, with the first film, we hear so much about the leaders of the civil rights movement who
were very important. So that's why the foot soldiers you keep referring to.
But I felt that it was important to give voice to those who were in the trenches.
Leaders can do nothing without people
exactly.
to lead. Yes, of
exactly.
course.
Exactly. It took all of those who were putting their lives on the line behind the leaders.
Yes.
And the same with the soldiers who are fighting the wars. You know, we can have politicians making decisions to send people to war.
Ugh.
But when you talk to Aaron and see what he's actually lived through.
So you've gone from never mind the statistics and the overall, this is the human beings involved here.
And I think that because of the way I connect with people, I think by taking one person's story.
Yes.
We can really understand it where, you know, if you just look at the masses, it's hard to have that personal connection.
100% hard. And also one person's story. I mean, the word you used is absolutely what's necessary. It's the story.
Yes.
You know, there's so many moments of just a minute's silence for the list of soldiers who have died.
Right.
And the statistics. And, you know, I don't even know how they're useful. Whereas this is, I can see how it's useful.
Yeah, the statistics, it's overwhelming.
Right.
And it does, again, it's such, it leaves
and
us
And people
with
don't
the,
relate to numbers, they relate to people.
Exactly.
Good for you.
Exactly. So.
So, I, you know, it's so tempting to ask what's next for you, but I'm not going to, because when you do a next one, will you come back and tell us about that?
I would love
that?
To.
Okay. My question is, because Love Letters is me. And it turns out Love Letters is everybody. Who would you write a love letter to right now? And I hope you go home and do it.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, this is a hard one.
A little homework. Because you're in between movies now. You have a little time, right? All you need is like an hour. or 5 minutes.
I would love to. Yeah, so many. I have such a great, wonderful, supportive family, but I would have to say.
Wait, you just said something. You said yes. So many, but love letters isn't a one-shot deal. It's really a way of life that when you have something positive that you feel, write it down, stamp it, and mail it to somebody and make somebody else's life richer.
Oh, I love that.
So go ahead, because I've got a couple of thoughts, too.
Okay. I would have to, can I choose two? Can I
send
it to?
You can choose 150.
Can I send it to my two amazing sons?
Yes, yes. And
Joshua and Christopher.
Okay, so love letters are usually about the other guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, another person's wonderful qualities. And maybe, I don't know, what would you want to say to them just in a minute about them that means something to you?
I call them my men of honor.
Oh, lovely.
They have just, you know, I've watched them grow from children. I'm just so proud of them, everything they've done, who they are. They now have families of their own, and I watch them as husbands and fathers, and it just is, they bring me so much joy.
Okay, so and specifics, like what about them? What do they do that makes them men of honor? And specifics are important because, you know, you just said one person's story, not
yes.
Generalizations. So,
well,
one of the things is that his children will find them long after we're all gone. And maybe your grandchildren will find them and they'll know the legacy they came from.
They've done so much, but I'll talk about one part of my life that mm-hmm. was one of the hardest parts of my life. And my sons helped me through it.
Oh,
during the making of my first film, mm-hmm. my husband unexpectedly left, and it was quite a shock, and I went through a very difficult divorce during it, and it was my sons who wrapped themselves around me and were there, and I don't know how I would have survived
it without
them.
Oh, well, there's your love letter.
Yes.
Okay, so to each of them, in your own handwriting, because when they find this and when their children and grandchildren find it, because these things last for a long time, good ink and indelible ink and good paper, important for it to last.
Yes.
And they read it and they bring it out of some attic or some trunk and they will be touching something that felt the touch of your hand 100 years ago.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That is just so important. But I'm also thinking, does Mr. Armstrong have children and grandchildren?
Mr. Armstrong has 4 children, and he does have grandchildren. And this film, one of the most rewarding things for me was to see it bring his family together again, because they left Birmingham very young, and they all went to separate states, and they had very, very hard experiences, you know, being children through the civil rights movement, being children who they felt were used as, you know, the sacrificial lambs at being, you know, integrated into a school. So they left Birmingham and they felt their father was also married to the movement and he wasn't there for them. But we had a screening in Birmingham with over 2,000 people, and the mayor, the governor came, many of the foot soldiers.
Hey.
All of Mr. Armstrong's children were given medals and honored and treated in a way they hadn't been when they were there. And they wrote to me afterwards and said, you have no idea the healing.
Oh, so you got letters.
The healing taken place because they were able to see in a different light through this film what their father's vision was.
Well, you know, I'm listening to this and I can see where children can feel totally abandoned.
Yes.
However, if, you know, I look at this and I see your father was trying to make the world a safe place to leave them after he was gone.
And when you're a child, you don't see that, but they were able to now as
he did it for them.
Adults. He did it for them.
Yes. Yes.
And his,
so I'm thinking of a love letter to him for what he allowed you to do, but sending it to his children.
Mm.
There's so many backdoor ways to make these, but if you've got letters from them, that's just wonderful. And your partner in this first movie, who passed away.
Yes.
Does she have children?
She does. In fact, I heard from her daughter today. She has one daughter and she has, and now has a child of her own. And
so love letters to all these people. Just a drop in the mailbox. And they'll keep it forever.
I love that.
Oh, thank you
thank
so much
you.
For doing this
oh,
with
this
me.
This is wonderful. Thank
oh, I'm
you.
Just, I'm just so close to not being able to speak here, which is a stretch for me. But just, you know, listening to these personal stories.
Well, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, dear.
For
well,
me
I'm
letting
I'm
me
just
share
gonna,
this.
Well, thank you for the generosity of doing it. This is huge. And I hate to say goodbye to you, but for now, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye. And please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, two things. Writing a love letter is a special occasion, and your days are filled with occasions that have the seeds of a love letter to someone. And I'm going to say goodbye till next time. Thank you.